how every word would be interpreted and how each act would affect the near future. We simply knew by the power of God everything we needed to do. Our intelligence was also dramatically increased. Like a chess grandmaster, we could discern complex solutions to anything we encountered, seeing the resulting chain of events long before they occurred. Actually, this was a joy to me. Having done so much struggling to educate myself, I found I loved feeling my improved intellect, absorbing vast truths and solving impenetrable mysteries. With all this, we also adored receiving revelation and confirmation from our God that our conclusions were true and celestially purposed. In fact, this superhuman intellect was revelation to us. It was lifting the veil just a little and revealing who we really were. Any grand miracle one reads about in the scriptures, which we rightly call miracles, was duplicated in far greater degree and with great regularity by the citizens and ministers from Zion. Miracles were routinely wrought that were far greater than dividing the Red Sea. We always marveled, but we were no longer surprised by such things. We were experiencing another reason this was called the fullness of times, because not only did we have all these gifts and powers of God manifested hourly among us, but they were manifested with greater power and in a greater degree than ever in the history of the world. Some members of our 144,000 were sent on assignments that took years as they actually walked every step of the way with their charges back to Zion. This was particularly evident in the gathering of some of the lost tribes. Some of my dear friends served in this very way, and their work was glorious. My mission seemed to be more short-term. I would go and work with people, then return to Zion for a while, and when the Holy Spirit moved me, I would return to guide and encourage them. Time was fluid for us. There were no deadlines. We could go to any group, even in their past, to prepare them, then move forward in time and visit them again, or do anything the Lord directed us to do, to accomplish our work. But even among the 144,000, not all of us learned to use time in the way I just described. Everything depended upon agency and our diligence in learning how to use our gifts, just as has always been and will always be. Not every translated person had the same gifts or even the same interests. We grew as our agency and inspiration guided us until we truly came to a measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ. It was true that all of the rest of the world was moving forward in time as it is now, and as it continued throughout the millennium. But for me and others of the 144,000, we could go for months or years and then arrive back a few minutes after we had left. Since we were tireless and did not need sleep or food, we could continue this pattern of service without end, and we rejoiced in it. We grew weary neither in mind, soul, nor body. Every day was a Sabbath to us, and we communed with God and renewed our covenants with every breath we took. We met often, communing with angels and our Savior, but I do not recall attending an organized sacrament meeting. It was only because of this ability to work with time, as opposed to being subject to it, that we actually completed the gathering prior to the Master's coming in glory. Close to the end of our ministry to gather in the elect, there was a large body of people who had the seer stones and who worked with us. But I do not believe there were exactly 144,000 of us. That number evolved daily and may have actually exceeded that number toward the end. Our numbers were great. The Second Coming. As I have mentioned, my perception of time was not as linear as it is now. A whole day in Zion could amount to years of service on the other side of the portal. I don't recall ever being confused about what time I was in on either side of the portal, but you have to remember that I was not actually in Zion, but in vision at my home in my bed. After the vision ended, and I had returned to my mortal body, the sequence and times of things became much more difficult to decipher. For this reason, the exact timing of the second coming is indistinct to me. It was a while after we arrived in Zion, perhaps no longer than 3.5 years. By the time Christ came in glory, the work of gathering had been completed. We had worked night and day for all of those years to finish the work. We had gathered into Zion every single soul Christ had sent us to in the entire world. We had not missed a soul. When he came, we were actively waiting for the day. As I mentioned earlier, there were millions of terrestrial people, the good and honorable of the earth, to whom we were not sent. They would abide the day of his coming, but they did not partake of the protection and glory of Zion prior to his coming. We did no work among the warring and evil. We were only gathering the elect, those whom the Father had placed into Christ's power, they that are Christ's at his coming. Early one morning, we beheld billowing clouds crossing the sky from east to west. We did not sleep, so we often gathered to watch the sun come up. This was different. These clouds were pure white and billowing, rolling towards us from top to bottom like an unrolling scroll. There was no wind or lightning, and the clouds had no dark underside. We had been actively watching for the day of his coming. Even minutes before we saw the billowing clouds, we did not know the day nor hour when he would return, but the instant we saw it, our hearts jumped up into our throats, and we cried aloud with joy and relief, "He is coming! He is coming!" We cried with every energy of our souls. Every soul in Zion and all of her cities felt our joy and ran outside to see this long-awaited moment. All of the inhabitants of Zion and her cities were watching when he came. We all heard a voice speak to us individually. I heard my name tenderly spoken. As before, everything that I am was contained within that sound, including all that Christ loved about me. It thrilled me with unspeakable joy. Everyone heard their own name at the same time. I immediately recognized it as the voice of Jesus Christ, as did all of my fellow Zion dwellers. The good and honorable of the earth, whom we had not gathered, felt the spiritual magnificence of the moment and looked up. In an instant they began to rejoice as well, jumping toward heaven with their arms over their heads, as if trying to at last fly off of the earth and into his arms. The benighted of the world perceived the sound as a mighty roaring and piercing sound, somewhat like an enormous wind screaming as a devastating earthquake rumbling toward them. Instantly, there was a crushing terror in their hearts. They did not know that it was Jesus Christ returning and would not have believed anyone who said so. They thought it was another devastation coming. Others thought it was a missile or a new weapon. Some of the enemies of Zion thought we had finally launched a mighty weapon at them. As the cloud approached, it became apparent that there was a man standing in the cloud. Even 1,000 miles away, every eye saw him approaching in the clouds of heaven. Evil men fell to their knees and wept. Some took their own lives. The hardened among them turned their weapons toward the coming Christ and opened fire. It would be their last act of defiance. We in Zion recognized his voice, and it was sweet and comforting to us. His voice told us to return to the temple quickly. By this time, there were many temples across the world. Some were Latter-day temples that had been upgraded to the millennial form. Most were new, built during this prelude to the millennium. Each group gathered into their temple, some into dedicated church buildings, even in homes the inhabitants had made holy, and the conference center in Salt Lake City. There was room enough for all who heard his voice. We dropped everything and ran. We didn't need to turn back to gather children or families. They all heard his call and came in that instant. Even infants heard and were brought by loving hands. We entered the temple through the outer temple that was dedicated to our tribe of Israel. For me and my family and most of my friends, it was the outer temple for Ephraim on the east side of the temple. We did not have time to change clothes, but each of us began glowing with purity that exceeded temple white. We were praising and singing and praying and rejoicing. The day was finally come, finally come, finally come. We gathered in the large assembly hall where our prophets began speaking to us, reading scriptures, and rejoicing aloud in what was happening. We were all prepared, and we sang new hymns we had never heard before with mighty fervor. To my ears, it was the most beautiful sound humans have ever produced. Brightness and glory surrounded us, penetrated us, cleansed us even further. We were still in the temple, but the roof and part of the walls became transparent so that we could see the sky. We could hear angels singing with us and blowing trumpets that shook the earth. At last we saw Jesus Christ coming from the east, surrounded by billowing clouds and numerous angels all singing and praising the Father. Even though he was still hundreds of miles away, we could see his face clearly. He was clothed in spotless white, with a red sash around his waist. His face was not angry, but he was not smiling. He was coming to cleanse the earth. He approached quickly and was soon above us. The temple was no longer visible to us. We were being taken up. We all felt the pull of gravity begin to release us. I saw the clouds growing closer, even as my soul expanded as broad as the universe, and then the vision closed. I could say I wish it were more, but in all truth, it was all I could take in. I was fully enraptured, filled with exquisite joy and rejoicing. Anything more than this would have been overwhelming and incomprehensible in my mortal state, and I would not have been able to retain the memory. The Red Planet. From this point on, my experiences in this vision became small glimpses of the future. I saw that Zion had spread to fill the whole earth, and that the 1,000 years had nearly elapsed. I saw that there were small nations, if you will, who had not embraced the gospel, but who had embraced the blessings of the millennium. These were they who asked to be taught how to live in peace, but wanted nothing to do with our religion or our God. They simply did not believe in Jesus Christ. They did not believe that it was actually Jesus Christ who had returned, even though they had seen him. These were those people who had not been consumed by his coming, but who could not abandon their cultural beliefs and traditions. They did not believe that Zion dwellers lived as long as was rumored, or that we did not experience disease and death. They thought this millennial state was the result of changes in the earth, vast technologies, and the fulfillment of prophecies inherent to their traditional religion. Because of their agency, they were free to believe anything they wished. They were honorable people. They were also deceived. When they requested help or knowledge, we gave them as much as they could absorb, because most of our technology was spiritual, not technical. Their millennial experience was hampered by their lack of faith. They had never been our enemies, and still were not, but they lived separately from us, in a society that depended upon primitive manufacturing and an economy-driven social order. Had their society been established prior to the millennium, all the world would have viewed it as utopia. To us of Zion, it looked harsh and primitive. We sent missionaries among them, but their hearts were fixed. At the point of this vision, they still existed apart from Zion. I must have still been working in Zion, or perhaps I had come back to witness this event. I'm not sure. I found myself standing with a sizable group upon a hill just outside of the holy city. We were watching a planet pass close by the earth. The sky grew dark as this planet came into view. We were able to see how the few people outside of Zion were reacting via the seer stones we all possessed. We didn't need to pull them from our pockets and look into them. The knowledge was transferred to our awareness merely by our wondering or wanting to know. There was great terror among them and a doomsday mentality. They ran about with reckless abandon and resignation, preparing for mass extinction. What remained of premillennial society crumbled and was never restored. I saw many people die of fear, but I also saw many of them fall upon their knees and cry out to Christ. Of course, he comforted them. Citizens of Zion gathered these last few and took them to safety at last. We upon the hill were at peace. There was no fear, only deep interest. The planet was close, red-orange in color, with impact craters across its face. As it passed, it was close enough that we could see mountains and valleys, former rivers, and fine details upon its surface. This planet was at rest and had no life upon it. It filled about a third of the whole sky. We commented among ourselves how different the new sky was. The constellations were entirely different, and the old moon was gone. The sky was crystal clear, and because of our translated state, we saw it perfectly. We understood this planet, where it had been, how it had served God, where it now rested, and why we were passing it, but that knowledge has not remained with me. It did no damage to the earth and had no effect upon us. We understood, of course, that it was the earth that was moving, not this big, old, faithful planet in our sky. It moved beyond us slowly until it was no longer visible. A new heaven and a new earth. The next little vision I saw took me to a time after the millennium. I was viewing the earth from out in space, as we call it now. The earth had been moved to a new location far beyond the galaxy we call the Milky Way. This had been accomplished by the same folding process that had placed the earth in its mortal rotation around our sun. There was a new heaven here. All of the stars were different. They were brighter and glorified. There was a massive sun in the sky, which I understood to be the greatest of all the creations of God, and where Father and our Savior dwelt. I was looking at the new earth beneath me. It was glowing nearly as brightly as the sun. The earth had been celestialized, and presently there were no people upon the earth, and nothing remained of man's long tenure there. Everything man had built was gone, as well as trees, grass, and flowers. The earth was perfectly smooth, and as clear as glass. It was itself a giant Urim and Thummim. The earth had died at the end of the millennium, and had now been resurrected by God. It was at long last prepared to host those who had once lived as mortals upon her face, and who were finally qualified to dwell in her fiery glory. The judgment day had just occurred, and every former inhabitant of the earth was now dwelling in their new kingdoms, except the celestial kingdom. The earth was now ready to become that celestial abode, but for one finishing detail. I was with a large group of people who were returning to the earth with a large city. We were not in or on the city, but beside it, bringing it with us. We were moving through space at a rapid pace, bringing the first of many cities to the earth. We were a vast company of those who had run the good race, who had fought the good fight, and finished the course. Any one of us could have brought this city by ourselves, but we were there to share in this eternally historic event, because this was our celestial home now for the remainder of eternity. The city beside me was the most beautiful structure ever created. God himself had designed it, and we had been sent to construct it. Not only was it incomparably beautiful, but it was glorious beyond any mortal ability to describe it. I thought then, and now as I am attempting to describe it, that such beauty could have only come from the mind of God. It was a single glorious building, but it was the size of a city, glowing white with sparkling accents of color. We brought it from the presence of Father, to be the first and greatest structure on the earth. It was well over a square mile, a mile high, and with its many spires, arches, and architectural wonders, it was approximately pyramidal in shape. This would be the residence of our Savior, who was now to dwell with us forever. As we slowed to place the city at the exact northern pole of the new earth, I knew that we could reshape the earth to anything we desired. We could call forth gardens, rivers, or mountains in endless variety and wonder, but the era of green grass was past, because those things belonged to the celestial and terrestrial orders, and the earth was now celestial. Those things which had been wondrous and beautiful to us before would eventually not even come to mind anymore, for the wonder and glory before us far exceeded all other possible orders of living. I recall feeling total, absolute joy. It was not only joy for ourselves, but also for the earth, which had waited so long and faithfully for evil to be wiped from her face. She was now glorified and perfected, and finally at rest. And we were finally home. The journey was finally over. A million years of preparation, mortal life, trials and suffering, 1,000 years of work in the millennium and the judgment were now done, and our lives were about to begin. I suddenly found myself back in my spirit body, standing at the foot of my bed, looking at my dead body. My guide was standing beside me, looking at me. I glanced at the digital clock on my bedstand, and the third hour had passed. This is the end of the vision. But as I felt myself returning to my cold and diseased body, I also realized with great solemnity that it was only the beginning of my journey. Afterword. Having penned nearly 100,000 words in Spencer's voice from his vast experiences, I feel it worthwhile to say a few things on my own. It has been a thoroughly amazing experience to write Visions of Glory. I have come to view it as an authorized biography of Spencer's visionary journey to Zion. If you were to ask me if I believe that his visions are true, I would reply that I have felt the Holy Spirit working upon me as I transcribed it from his words to mine. Every experience you have just read, and all major details, came from Spencer's lips. I will also confess that I have been intrigued by the fact that nothing Spencer told me conflicted with my own view of the latter days. What he described to me was congruent with both my spiritual and intellectual understanding of those times. For me, it was like reading a book and loving it, then going and seeing the movie. His experiences added the visual depth that my prior reading lacked. I do believe that Spencer saw what he saw, but I don't believe it should always be interpreted as literal or even prophetic for anyone but Spencer himself. Anyone else who reads must interpret how or even if it applies to them. I think it should be prayerfully studied and compared to Scripture, your own understanding, and your faith, and then left to Jesus Christ himself to reveal to you your own journey to Zion. Anyone who has studied the latter days, the second coming, or the building of Zion in Scripture will quickly admit that it is hard to interpret, and most of it is given as a metaphor or type of things to come, rather than as specific and actual events to watch for. I wouldn't expect Spencer's visions to be any different. My answer will also be that I don't know what it should mean to you or to anyone else who reads it. Spencer will readily admit that he doesn't know what every part of it means to even him still. Some things that for years he has interpreted as being literal have recently revealed themselves to be metaphorical, and the other way around. All he really knows is that for whatever reason he saw what he saw, and the Lord has given him permission after all of these years to share it with us. If you look at the overall theme of his experiences, you will see elements of every person's journey to Zion, whether it is to the Zion we will build in Missouri or the spiritual Zion we must each build in our hearts. Ultimately, both viewpoints may be accurate in the sense that when one makes the spiritual journey, the physical journey may also unveil itself before us. John M. Pontius. Appendix. The following apocryphal dreams and visions are included as an illustration that many others have seen and recorded similar visions of the latter days, as did Spencer. It is also interesting to observe that some of these were not LDS, and yet they saw parallel views of these times. In addition to these few examples, I am sure others exist in hearts that are too timid to reveal them. Such was the case with Spencer until recently. After Spencer had dictated this book, I remembered a few of these and pointed them out to Spencer. He was surprised they existed and read them with interest. I should also point out that some of these descriptions are rather graphic and should be read to children and tender souls with some discretion. John Taylor's Dream, 1877. I went to bed as usual about 7:30 p.m. I had been reading a revelation in the French language. My mind was calm, more so than usual if possible, so I composed myself for sleep, but could not. I felt a strange feeling come over me, and apparently became partially unconscious. Still, I was not asleep, nor exactly awake, with dreary feeling. The first thing that I recognized was that I was in the tabernacle of Ogden, Utah. I was sitting in the back part of the building for fear they would call on me to preach, which, however, they did, for after singing the second time they called me to the stand. I arose to speak and said that I didn't know that I had anything especially to say, except to bear my testimony of the latter-day work, when all at once it seemed as if I was lifted out of myself, and I said, "Yes, I have something to say, and that is this. Some of my brethren have been asking, 'What is becoming of us? What is the wind blowing?' I will answer you right here what is coming very shortly." I was then in a dream, immediately in the city of Salt Lake, and wandering around the streets and in all parts of the city, and on the doors of the houses I found badges of mourning, and I could not find a house, but was in mourning. I passed my own house, and found the same sign there, and I asked the question, "Is that me that is dead?" Someone gave me the answer, "No, you will get through it all." It seems strange to me that I saw no person in the streets and in all my wandering around the country. I seemed to be in their houses with the sick, but saw no funeral procession nor anything of the kind, but the city looking still and as though the people were praying. And it seemed that they had controlled the disease, but what the disease was I did not learn. It was not made known to me. I then looked over the country, north, east, south, and west, and the same mourning was in every land and in every place. The next thing I knew, I was just this side of Omaha. It seemed as though I was above the earth and looking down upon it. As I passed along upon my way east, I saw the road full of people, mostly women, with just what they could carry in bundles on their backs, traveling to the mountains on foot. I wondered how they would get through with such a small pack on their backs. It was remarkable to us that there were so few men among them. It didn't seem to me as though the cars were running. The rails looked rusty and the roads abandoned, and I have no conception of how I traveled as I looked down upon the people. I continued east by the way of Omaha and Council Bluffs, which were full of disease. There were women everywhere. The state of Illinois and Missouri were in a tumult, men killing one another, women joining the fighting, family against family, in the most horrid manner. I imagined next that I was in Washington, and I found desolation there. The White House was empty, and the halls of Congress the same, and everything in ruins. The people seemed to have left the city, and left it to take care of itself. I was in Baltimore, in the square where the monument of 1812 stands in front of the Charles Hotel. I saw dead piled up so as to fill the street square. I saw mothers cutting the throats of their own children for their blood. I saw them suck it from their throats to quench their own thirst, and then lie down and die. The water of Chesapeake Bay was stagnant, and the stench arising from it on account of their throwing their bodies into it so terrible that the very smell carried death with it. I saw no man except they were dead or dying in the streets, and very few women. Those I saw were crazy and in an ugly condition. Everywhere I went, I beheld the same sights all over the city. It was terrible beyond description to look upon. I thought this must be the end, but no, I was seemingly in an instant in the city of Philadelphia. There everything was still. No living soul was there to greet me. It seemed the whole city was without any inhabitants. In the south of Chestnut Street, and in fact everywhere I went, the putrefaction of the dead caused such a stench that it was impossible for any living thing to breathe, nor did I see any living thing in the city. Next, I found myself in Broadway, in the city of New York, and there it seemed the people had done the best they could to overcome the disease, but in wandering down Broadway, I saw the bodies of beautiful women lying, some dead and others in a dying condition on the sidewalks. I saw men come out of cellars and ravish the person of some that were yet alive and then kill them and rob their bodies of all the valuables they had upon them. Then before they could get back to the cellar, they would roll over a time or two and die in agony. In some of the back streets, I saw them kill some of their own offspring and eat their raw flesh, and in a few minutes die themselves. Everywhere I went, I saw the same scene of horror and destruction and death and rapine. No carriages, buggies, or cars were running, but death and destruction were everywhere. Then I saw fire start, and just at that moment a mighty east wind sprang up and carried the flames over the city, and it burned until there was not a single building left standing there, even down to the water's edge. Wharves and shipping all seemed to burn and follow in common destruction where the great city was a short time ago. The stench from the bodies that were burning was so great that it was carried a long distance across the Hudson Bay and carried death and destruction wherever it penetrated. I cannot paint in words the horror that seemed to compass me about. It was beyond description of man. I suppose this was the end, but it was not. I was given to understand the same horror was being enacted all over the country, east, west, north, and south. Few were left alive. Still, there were some. Immediately after I seemed to be standing on the left bank of the Missouri River, opposite the city of Independence, but there was no city. I saw the whole state of Missouri and Illinois and all of Iowa, a complete desert with no living being there. A short distance from the river, however, I saw 12 men dressed in temple robes, standing in a square or nearly so, and I understood it represented the 12 gates of the New Jerusalem. Their hands were uplifted in consecration of the ground and laying the cornerstone of the temple. I saw myriads of angels hovering over them, and saw also an immense pillar of clouds over them, and heard the angels singing the most heavenly music. The words were, "Now is established the kingdom of God and his Christ, which shall never more be thrown down." I saw people coming from the river and from the desert places a long way off to help build the temple, and it seemed that hosts of angels all helped to get material to build with, and I saw some of them who wore temple clothes come and build the temple and the city. And all the time I saw the great pillar of clouds hovering over the place. Instantly, however, I found myself again in the tabernacle at Ogden. And yet, I could see the building going on, and I got quite animated in calling on the people in the tabernacle to listen to the beautiful music, for the angels were singing the same music I had heard before. "Now is established the kingdom of God and his Christ, which shall never more be thrown down." At this, I seemed to stagger back from the pulpit, and Brother Francis D. Richards and some others caught my arm and prevented me from falling. Then I finished so abruptly. Still, even then, I had not fainted, but was simply exhausted. Then I rolled over in bed and awoke, just as the city clock was striking 12. Wilford Woodruff Journals, June 15, 1878, Church Historian's Office. Also manuscript copy of the same copied by Joseph F. Smith. Unpublished Revelations, 78, page 119 to 123. See also Visions of the Latter Days, page 103 to 106. The Cardston Prophecy, 1923, by Soles Cardisto. The Cardston Prophecy, which I have reproduced here, is found in the family file of Edward J. Wood, and was included in the book The Life of Edward J. Wood by Melvin Tagg, pages 148 to 153. The following is a letter from Edward J. Wood, then president of the Cardston, Alberta stake, regarding the author of this vision. Cardston, Alberta, Canada, December 14, 1933. Robert W. Smith, Esquire, Salt Lake City, Utah. Dear Brother Smith, I am pleased to answer your letter of December 1st. First, as to the letter of a non-member who wrote of impressions received while going through the temple before it was dedicated, the truth of which letter you asked me to verify, and which I am pleased to do. It was a Quaker lady who was a magazine writer from eastern Canada. She has some relatives in Lethbridge, about 60 miles from Cardston, and being so deeply impressed on her first visit, she had them bring her a second time. This time I was acting as guide. She would sit in each room and never said a word to any in the company, but seemed to be in deep meditation all of the time. When she reached her own home several weeks after, she wrote this letter, which has caused so much comment all over the church. We have never been able to understand how she seemed to know so much about our faith and our belief in our future life and works after death. I never learned her real name. She visited us along in 1921. I have never heard from her since that time, but the letter is genuine, and of her own impressions, received while in the temple, while on two visits she mentions. Sincerely your brother, O/S, Elder J. Wood, President, Alberta Stake. This is her letter and vision in her own words. We have been to the temple erected by your church, wherein are to be performed the sacred rites in accordance with your faith. The first time I was strongly impelled to describe to you my impressions. I did so, but before the completion of the letter, I received some news that so affected me that acting upon the spur of the moment, I destroyed the document in its entirety. The continued feeling within me of dissatisfaction as to something left undone, coupled with the desire upon the part of the members of my household who had not visited the temple, led to our second visit to Cardston, in which you so kindly consented to accompany us, notwithstanding the inclement weather and personal inconvenience to yourself which the journey entailed. It was because of this, and many other evidences of your friendship, that has given me the privilege to presume to bother you with what, after all, may be foolish fantasies of a too impressionable mentality. To me it does seem so, for never before in my life have such powerful impressions been infringed upon my inner consciousness as during my visit through the temple. Especially was this true at our second visit. The impressions of our first visit were repeated with such overwhelming intensity and variety of detail that I must positively inform you of my experience. It seems to me it were a sacred duty upon my part to do this, and knowing as I do that your friends will lightly ridicule what to me is a personal matter, I am going to give you in detail my experience in the hope that if it is well, maybe it is something more than imagination, that you and others of your faith may wisely analyze and correctly use whatever may be gleaned from this letter. A fortress in time of storm was the first thought that shaped itself in my mind with my first view of this ancient yet modern temple, mellowed with the spiritual usage of ancient civilization and customs, yet alert, virile, and watchful. A grand, solemn, strong, beautiful, useful house of spiritual progression, which seemed to be the embodiment of architectural expression of ancient civilization and glories suddenly reincarnated and for a future and higher civilization than our own. Strength and beauty exaggerated the more flimsy houses and buildings of the town and gave a painfully obvious example of how the soul within is expressed through the material body, either in the individual or nation or a race, either in the man or his architecture. Try how I would, I could not get away from the feeling that the town itself was inferior to the latest building, so new and yet so old. Even the electric lights failed to change this thought, that the temple and the town represented two different epochs of humanity's spiritual development expressed in architecture. The town embodied the present epoch, science, art, invention harnessed purely for trade or commerce, irrespective of past or future development. The temple embodies that accumulated knowledge of the ancient world combined with the modern inventions of science and inspiration as the road to a higher future development so near at hand. Let me put it down even another way. There is a place called Cardston. A temple linking the past with the present has been built at Cardston, and the town has become a collection of flimsy huts nestling at the foot of the temple, which will continue to function for the spiritual purposes for which it is raised. Just as the exterior impressions compared with the present and future epochs, so did the interior also reflect comparison. Of the beautiful and artistic effects I need not dwell. Abler pens can describe the interior from this viewpoint. Sufficient for me to say that the shape of the temple is a cross, that each apartment is symbolical in artistic and structural effects of some stage of humanity's progress through the ages. In fact, everything physical is a stepping stone to spiritual progress, as such is typified in these ceremonies. All this was kindly and intelligently explained to us by Mr. Deuce on one occasion and by Mr. Wood on the second visit. But I am afraid I was very indifferent and inattentive upon both occasions, for which I tender them my sincere apologies. I had no intentions of being rude or discourteous, but from the moment of entering the temple until leaving, I was placed in the position of having, as it were, to listen to and grasp a dual narrative all the time, with the result that so engrossed was I at times that I am afraid I was so absent-minded as to appear inattentive if not positively stupid. I have stated that my impression of the exterior of the building was that of a place of waiting for a higher civilization than our present one. This would suggest a condition of emptiness, but that is not what I mean. An ordinary newly erected building has no atmosphere at all until it has been inhabited some time, after which it has, as it were, a living atmosphere. What kind of an atmosphere this is largely determined by the spiritual development and thought of the persons using and inhabiting the building. This applies especially to places of worship or consecration, and is very noticeable to a sensitive person. Sometimes such an atmosphere is agreeable, exalting, and so on. Sometimes very much the reverse, depending upon the spiritual harmony or otherwise of the persons under this atmospheric rule, but was not so far as it was concerned while outside the temple. I could not understand the overwhelming scene of ancient atmosphere which the building actually possessed in its very granite blocks, in spite of the fact that I know a few months previously these stones had been laid, yet the feeling of age predominated. I dismissed the feeling as well as I could by thinking that the place of the structure was responsible for the suggestion of age, but when I entered the temple, how quickly I found there was nothing to suggest to me that present atmosphere of which I have spoken. But was it empty? Emphatically, no. Time and again, as I listened to the speaker explaining some phase of the building or its meaning, I would be seeing beyond him some illustration of kaleidoscopic nature, depicting what he was describing, only more completely and vividly. The characters were so plain to me that I required all my self-control to keep silent from room to room. This continued and only ceased when we were out in the frost and snow once more. There was no set plan for presenting these pictures to me. It seemed as if when I thought something mental, a picture instantly presented itself in explanation of some word of the conductor, which would have the same effect. I was not afraid, only awed by the wonder of it all, and the fearful, impressive feeling that I received, which seemed to embed every little detailed scene into my brain, from which it will ever remember and record. And vivid as all of it was, these incidents herein related are the ones upon which I received instructions. The scenes which I observed of an historical character seemed chiefly to verify and amplify the speaker's outline of past history, and so I do not feel impressed to record such, except to state that the same patriarchal characters, whom I observed directing and influencing the early movements of the church, were the same down through every age and epoch. And as the scenes advanced to more modern times, I saw among these spiritual characters and counselors persons whose features I had previously observed as being in the material body on other historical occasions. It seemed as though the temple was filled with the actual spiritual bodies of these previous leaders of your church, each seeming to have the work that person was engaged in whilst in the flesh. In that temple I saw persons who were leaders of your church during its march across the American desert, now engaged in helping these higher patriarchs under whose orders they seemed to be working. It was these latter spiritual leaders, if I may use that term, who seemed to be instructed to show me the scenes here recorded. I can give no time as to the happening, except that the impressions I received were of actual present or immediate future. I saw first a brief but comprehensive sketch of the present state of the world, or as you would term it, the Gentile kingdoms. Each country in turn was shown, its anarchy, hunger, ambitions, distrusts, and warlike activities, and so on, and in my mind was formed from some source the words, "as it is today with the Gentiles." I saw international war break out, with its center upon the Pacific Ocean, but sweeping and encircling the whole globe. I saw that the opposing forces were roughly divided by so-called Christianity on the one side, and by the so-called followers of Muhammad and Buddha on the other. I saw that the great driving power within these so-called Christian nations was the great apostasy of Rome, in all its political, social, and religious aspects. I saw the worldwide dislocation and devastation of production and slaughter of people occur more swiftly and upon a larger scale than ever before. I saw an antagonism begin to express itself from those so-called Christian nations against your people. I saw those with a similar faith to yours in the Far East begin to look towards Palestine for safety. I saw the international world war automatically break down and national revolution occur in every country and complete the work of chaos and desolation. I saw geological disturbances occur, which helped in this work as if it were intended to do so. I saw the Cardston Temple preserved from all of this geological upheaval. I saw the international boundary line disappear as these two governments broke up and dissolved into chaos. I saw race rioting upon the American continent on a vast scale. I saw hunger and starvation in this world. I saw disease produced by hunger, strife, and chaos complete the end of this present order or epoch. How long these events were in reaching this consummation, I do not know. But my impression was from the outbreak of the international war, these things developed into a continual procession and almost ran concurrently, as it is with a sickness. The various symptoms are all in evidence at one and the same time, but in different stages of development. My intensified thought was, what of the church, if such is to become of the kingdoms of the earth? My question was immediately answered by a subconscious statement, as it is in the church today. And I saw these higher spiritual beings throughout the length and breadth of the air, marshaling their spiritual forces, and concentrating them upon the high officials of your church upon earth. I saw the spiritual forces working upon those officers, impressing and moving them, influencing and warning them. I saw the spiritual forces begin to unfold these things into the minds of your elders and other high officials, especially during their spiritual devotions and official duties, and those activities which exalt the mind of the individual or groups. I saw the impressions take hold and inspire the more receptive and spiritual men, until it was all clearly revealed to them in the way the spiritual patriarch desired. Again, I seemed to hear the words, "As it will be." I saw the high officials in council, and under inspired guidance issue instructions to your people to reconsecrate their lives and energies to their faith, to voluntarily discipline themselves, by abstaining from all those forms of indulgence which weaken the body, sap the mentality, and deaden the spirit, or waste the income. I saw further on, instructions given whereby places of refuge were prepared quietly but efficiently by inspired elders. I saw Cardston and the surrounding foothills, especially north and west, for miles, being prepared as a refuge for your people, quietly but quickly. I saw elders still under divine guidance, counseling and encouraging the planting of every available acre of soil in this district, so that large supplies would be near the refuge. I saw the church property under cultivation of an intensified character, not for sale or profit, but for the use of the people. I saw artisan wells and other wells dug all over the territory, so that when the open waters were polluted and poisoned, that the people of the church and their cattle should be provided for. I saw the fuel resources of the district develop in many places and vast piles of coal and timber stored for future use and building. I saw the territory carefully surveyed and mapped out for the camping of a great body of the people of the church. I saw provision also made for a big influx of people who will not at first belong to the church, but who will gather in their tribulation. I saw vast quantities of surgical appliances, medicines, disinfectants, and so on, stored in the temple basement. I saw inspiration given the elders, whereby the quantity, quality, and kinds of things to be stored were judged, which might not be attainable in this territory in time of chaos. I saw defensive preparations working out the organizations of camps on maps. I saw the mining corridors used as places of storage underground. I saw the hills surveyed and corrals built in sequestered places for cattle, sheep, and so on, quietly and quickly. I saw the plans for the organization of the single men and their duties, the scouts, the guards, the nurses, the cooks, the messengers, the children, the herders, the temple guards, and so on. I saw these things going on practically unknown to the Gentile world, except the great apostasy, whose knowledge and hatred is far-reaching, in this day of its temporary power. This was going on piece by piece as the elders were instructed to do so. I saw the other officials obeying the inspired instructions, carrying their message and exhorting the people to carry out, from time to time, the revelation given them, whilst all around throughout the Gentile world the chaos developed in its varying stages, faction against faction, nation against nation, but all in open or secret hostility to your people and their faith. I saw your people draw closer and closer together. As this became more tense, and as the spiritual forces warned them through the mouth of your elders and your other officers, I saw the spiritual forces influencing those members who had drifted away to re-enter the fold. I saw greater tithing than ever before. I saw vast quantities of necessaries supplied by members whose spiritual eyes had been opened. I saw a liquidation of properties and effects disposed of quietly but quickly by members of the church as the spiritual influences directed them. I saw the inspired call sent forth to all the church to gather to the refuges of Zion. I saw the stream of your people quietly moving in the direction of their refuge. I saw your people moving more quickly and in larger numbers until all the stragglers were housed. I saw the wireless message flashed from Zion's refuge to Zion's refuge in their several places that all was well with them. And then the darkness of chaos closed around the boundaries of your people, and the last days of tribulation had begun. Souls Cardisto. Warning to America, 1880, by President Wilford Woodruff. I warn future historians to give credence to my history, for my testimony is true, and the truth of its record will be manifest in the world to come. All the words of the Lord will be fulfilled upon the nations which are written in this book. The American nation will be broken in pieces like a potter's vessel, and will be cast down to hell if it does not repent, and this because of murders, whoredoms, wickedness, and all manner of abominations, for the Lord has spoken it. M. Cowley, Wilford Woodruff, History of His Life and Labors, Bookcraft, page 500. Destroying Angels Are Active, 1931, by President Wilford Woodruff. I refer to these things because I know not how long I may have the privilege of bearing my testimony of the gospel of Christ on the earth. The revelations that are in the Bible, the predictions of the patriarchs and prophets who saw by vision and revelation the last dispensation and fullness of times, plainly tell us what is to come to pass. The 49th chapter of Isaiah is having its fulfillment. I have often said in my teachings, if the world wants to know what is coming to pass, let them read the revelations of St. John. Read of the judgments of God that are going to overthrow the world in the last dispensation. Read the papers and see what is taking place in our own nation and in the nations of the earth. And what does it all mean? It means the commencement of the fulfillment of what the prophets of God have predicted. In the Doctrine and Covenants there are many revelations given through the mouth of the prophet of God. These revelations will all have the fulfillment, as the Lord lives, and no power can hinder it. In one of the revelations the Lord told Joseph Smith, Behold, verily I say unto you, the angels are crying unto the Lord day and night, who are ready and waiting to be sent forth to reap down the fields. I want to bear testimony to this congregation, and to the heavens and the earth, that the day is come when those angels are privileged to go forth and commence their work. They are laboring in the United States of America. They are laboring among the nations of the earth, and they will continue. We need not marvel or wonder at anything that is transpiring in the earth. The world does not comprehend the revelations of God. They did not in the days of the Jews, yet all that the prophets had spoken concerning them came to pass. So in our day these things will come to pass. I heard the prophet Joseph Smith bear his testimony to these events that would transpire in the earth. We cannot draw a veil over the events that await this generation. No man that is inspired by the Spirit and power of God can close his ears, his eyes, or his lips to these things. Wilford Woodruff, Millennial Star, 58, page 738 and 39. A Great Test Coming, 1930, by Heber C. Kimball. The western boundaries of the state of Missouri will be swept so clean of its inhabitants that, as President Young tells us, when we return to that place, there will not be so much as a yellow dog to wag his tail. Before that day comes, however, the saints will be put to the test that will try the best of them. The pressure will be so great that the righteous among us will cry unto the Lord day and night until deliverance comes. Then is the time to look out for the great sieve, for there will be a great sifting time, and many will fall. This church has before it many closed places through which it will have to pass before the work of God is crowned with glory. You cannot endure on borrowed light. Each will have to be guided by the light within themselves. If you do not have a knowledge that Jesus is the Christ, how can you stand? Do you believe it? General Conference Report, October 3rd through 5th, 1930, page 59. An Army of Elders, 1931, by Heber C. Kimball. An army of elders will be sent to the four quarters of the earth to search out the righteous and warn the wicked of what is coming. All kinds of religions will be started, and miracles performed that will deceive the very elect if such were possible. Our sons and daughters must live pure lives so as to be prepared for what is coming. After a while, the Gentiles will gather to this place by the thousands, and Salt Lake City will be classed among the wickedest cities of the world. A spirit of speculation and extravagance will take possession of the saints, and the results will be financial bondage. Persecution comes next, and all true Latter-day Saints will be tested to the limit. Many will apostatize, and others will stand still, not knowing what to do. Darkness will cover the earth, and gross darkness the minds of the people. The judgments of God will be poured out upon the wicked to the extent that our elders from far and near will be called home, or in other words, the gospel will be taken from the Gentiles and later on be carried to the Jews. The western boundary of the state of Missouri will be swept so clean of its inhabitants that, as President Young tells us, when you return to that place, there will not be left so much as a yellow dog to wag his tail. Before that day comes, however, the saints will be put to tests that will try the integrity of the best of them. The pressure will become so great that the more righteous among them will cry unto the Lord day and night until deliverance comes. Then the prophet Joseph and others will make their appearance, and those who have remained faithful will be selected to return to Jackson County, Missouri, and take part in the building of that beautiful city, the New Jerusalem. Heber C. Kimball, Deseret News, May 23, 1931. A Dream, 1894, Charles D. Evans. In August 1894, an article appeared in the Contributor, Volume 15, Number 20, page 638 through 647. The Contributor was the forerunner of the Improvement Era. The article was entitled A Dream. In the article, an account was given of a vision or dream of Charles D. Evans, a patriarch then living in Springville, Utah, of the last days, which is reproduced below. While I lay pondering in deep solitude on the events of my present, my mind was drawn into a reverie, such as I had never felt before. A strong solicitude for my imperiled country utterly excluded every other thought and raised my feelings to a point of intensity I did not think it possible to endure. While in this solemn, profound, and painful reverie of mind, to my infinite surprise, a light appeared in my room, which seemed to be soft and silvery as that diffused from a northern star. At the moment of its appearance, the acute feeling I had experienced instantly yielded to one of calm tranquility. Although it may have been at the hour of midnight, and the side of the globe whereon I was situated was excluded from the sunlight, yet all was light, and bright, and warm as an Italian landscape at noon. But the heat was softer and more subdued. As I gazed upward, I saw descending through my bedroom roof, with a gently gliding movement, a personage clothed in white apparel, whose countenance was smoothly serene, his features regular, and the flashes of his eyes seemed to shoot forth scintillations, to use an earthly comparison, strongly resembling those reflected from a diamond under an intensely illuminated electric light, which dazzled but did not bewilder. Those large, deep, inscrutable eyes were presently fixed upon mine, when instantly placing his hands upon my forehead, his touch produced an indescribable serenity and calmness, a calmness not born of earth, but at once peaceful, delightful, and heavenly. My whole being was imbued with a joy unspeakable. All feelings of sorrow instantly vanished. Those lines and shadows which care and sorrow impress upon us were dispelled as a deep fog before a blazing sun. In the eyes of my heavenly visitor, for such he appeared to me, there was a sort of lofty pity and tenderness infinitely stronger than any such feeling I ever saw manifested in ordinary mortals. His very calm appeared like a vast ocean stillness, at once overpowering to every agitated emotion. By some intuition or instinct, I felt he had something to communicate, to soothe my sorrows and allay my apprehensions. Whereon, addressing me, he said, "Son, I perceive that thou hast grave anxieties over the perilous state of thy country, that thy soul has felt deep sorrow for its future. I have therefore come to thy relief, and to tell thee of the causes that have led to this peril. Hear me attentively. 71 years ago, after an awful apostasy of centuries, in which all nations were shrouded in spiritual darkness, when the angels had withdrawn themselves, the voice of prophets hushed, and the light of Urim and Thummim shone not, and the vision of the seers was closed, while heaven itself shed not a ray of gladness to lighten a dark world, when Babel ruled and Satan laughed, and church and priesthood had taken their upward flight, and the voice of nations, possessing the books of the Jewish prophets,